The headlines: 3 U.S. Marines were killed and 20 others injured in a helicopter crash during military exercises in northern Australia. Several Palestinians are injured as Israeli forces storm the occupied West Bank city of Tulkarm, prompting violent clashes with resistance fighters. And Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa wins a second term in office in an outcome dismissed by the opposition. It's good to have you with us. A military helicopter crash in northern Australia has left 3 U.S. Marines dead and 20 others wounded. 5 Marines are in critical condition. The deadly incident happened after an Osprey military aircraft crashed during a military exercise in the northern island of Melville. Efforts are underway to transport all the injured soldiers to the hospital. According to the Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, no Australian personnel were involved in the crash. The helicopter was taking part in joint military drills involving thousands of soldiers from several countries. In the U.S., 3 people have been killed at a store in Jacksonville, Florida, by a white gunman in what police are saying was a racist rampage targeting black people.
This afternoon, a little after 1 p.m., an individual we have not yet officially identified entered a Dollar Tree in a Newtown area of Jacksonville, outfitted with a tactical vest, armed with an AR-style rifle and a handgun. Then the shooter killed 3 people before turning the gun on himself, taking his own life. Other than the 3 individuals killed and the shooter himself, there are no additional people who suffered gunshot wounds. We are not identifying the deceased victims at this time, but I can tell you that there are 2 male victims and 1 female victim. All of the deceased victims are black. This shooting was racially motivated, and he hated black people. He wanted to kill niggers. That's the one and only time I'll use that word.
This is a dark day in Jacksonville. Police said the shooter was armed with a high-powered rifle that was marked by swastikas. Officials said the suspect had left messages that detailed his hatred for black people. The FBI said federal officials had opened a civil rights investigation and would pursue the incident as a hate crime. At least 5 Palestinians have been injured in another Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank. The regime's forces stormed the northern city of Tulkarm, prompting violent clashes with resistance fighters. Tensions have been running high across the occupied West Bank in recent months as Israeli troops launched near daily raids there. Palestinians have increasingly also been fighting back and launching retaliatory operations. On Saturday, the regime forces stormed a village near the city of Jenin and arrested several Palestinians. However, they were forced to retreat after coming under fire from resistance fighters. Around 230 Palestinians have been killed at the hands of Israeli forces this year, and many others have been arrested. Our correspondent from Ramallah, Mona Kandil, earlier joined us for more details about the Israeli raid.
Early on Sunday, Israeli military raided Tulkarm city and remained there for over 4 hours, according to the residents of Tulkarm. They said that Israeli troops conducted an arrest raid. A number of Palestinians had been wounded, but the exact number is still unknown. Exchange of fire erupted between Israeli forces and the Palestinian fighters. Members of resistance groups from the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade and Saraya Al-Quds, the armed wing of the Jihad movement, according to those resistance groups who issued statements this morning, saying that their fighters exchange of fire and clashed with the Israeli forces for several hours in Tulkarm. Their fighters also hurled explosive devices at the Israeli military vehicles that forced the Israeli troops to end their military raid, and it was not a widespread military raid. However, during this operation, at least 5 Palestinians had been wounded. One of them has been shot in the his hand, and he was in a serious condition, according to Palestinian paramedics.
Protests over the judicial overhaul plan proposed by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right cabinet continues for the 34th consecutive week. The protesters are saying the 200-plus different proposals are turning Israel into a dictatorship. They say the regime is trying to control the Supreme Court and thus all three systems in Israel. Opposition believes the cabinet is aiming to weaken the judiciary and to prevent it from being able to maintain checks and balances on the cabinet. The opposition has also said that Netanyahu, who is currently on trial on charges of several counts of corruption, tries to use this game to quash possible judgments against them. Israel is facing public unrest, labor strikes, and mutiny by some members of the military. Muslims living in The Hague in the Netherlands have staged a protest condemning the desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden and in Denmark. Demonstrators gathered on the main street of The Hague and also outside of the Swedish embassy there to vent their anger at the sacrilegious move. They were holding copies of the Quran in their hands, reciting verses from the Muslims' holy book, denouncing the profane act. Recent desecrations of the Holy Quran in some European countries have drawn the ire of the Muslim community worldwide. Tehran is hosting an exhibition showcasing the current administration's achievements 2 years into his tenure. The most important product unveiled was a radioisotope called cesium-137. Our correspondent Gisumi Shahmedi joined us earlier from the site of the exhibition to explain what it is and what it's used for.
Now, what's important about this particular radioisotope is not simply the technology that is used and the know-how that is used in order to produce this radioisotope, which is essential both in industrial gauging and also in radiopharmaceuticals and in order to improve radiopharmaceutical medicine in Iran. But the most important issue regarding cesium-137 is that it is a byproduct of nuclear waste. So what's happened today, actually, is Iran unveiling the technology and the know-how to reuse its nuclear waste. As you know, Kaveh, nuclear waste is a great concern for any country that has to use nuclear material, has to deal with nuclear material in general. Nuclear waste is always a major concern. And being able to reuse this nuclear waste and bring it back to the cycle of using it as a radioisotope that have vast, areas in which they can be used, it is a great step forward.
Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa has won a second term in office. Official results announced by the country's Electoral Commission indicate that he won 52.6% of the ballots against 44% for the main challenger, Nelson Chamisa. However, the opposition has rejected the results, making accusations of vote rigging and voter suppression. The opposition hoped to emerge victorious due to the wave of discontent over the poor economic situation in the country. Mnangagwa's ruling ZANU-PF party was also declared the winner in the parliamentary race. Voter turnout was around 70%. Anti-French sentiment is growing in Niger after Paris defiantly insisted the military government in Niamey cannot expel its ambassador. Now military leaders have called on the people to turn up and to show their support for the government. They say the French envoy must leave the country.
The fight will not stop until the day there is no longer any French soldiers in Niger. We told them to leave our country to us, to leave, to let our country be. But it's you who will chase them away. To chase them away, don't go to the embassy. If the mobilization continues, they'll leave.
The French have been asked to leave, but they refused. We are going to defeat those plotting against our country. We are going to defeat them and stomp them out.
Victory to the people. It is the people of Niger who will decide what will become of this country. United, we stand.
Tens of thousands of people rallied in a stadium in the capital wearing and waving the country's flag. They expressed their full support for the country's military government that came to power following last month's coup. They also urged Western countries, especially France, to respect their choice of government. The military leaders in Niamey have accused Paris of seeking to use force in order to reinstate the ousted president. On Friday, they gave France's ambassador 48 hours to leave the country. British MP and former Minister Nadine Dorries has resigned from the Commons, accusing the Premier Rishi Sunak of endangering her safety by whipping up a public frenzy against her. Dorries lashed out at Sunak, saying that he had abandoned conservative principles. She also said the country is being run by a zombie parliament. Dorries was a key ally of the former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. In June, she announced her plan to quit with immediate effect after she was denied a seat in the House of Lords. Dorries accused Sunak's government of removing her name from the list and said she wanted to know why she was refused the seat. Let's find out more. Saeed Purza is a correspondent joining us from London. So tell us who Nadine Dorries is. I didn't know who she was. What is the beef that she has with Rishi Sunak? And what about the accusations that she has leveled against Sunak, if you can provide us with that, Saeed?
Good question, Kove. Nadine Dorries, of course, last served as culture secretary in the administration of Liz Truss, who took over from Boris Johnson. She also served in that government as health minister as well. She was the MP for Mid-Bedfordshire, which is a constituency in the so-called Blue Wall, which is decidedly conservative, since 2005. The beef she has with the prime minister, well, she was promised what they call peerage in the House of Lords, which means she would have stayed in the House of Commons as MP until the next general election and then moved on to the House of Lords for a permanent seat for a great dispensation for many years to come. And she believes that Rishi Sunak and a close aide to Rishi Sunak were the reason behind her denial of that peerage. So what she did was she announced that she was resigning, just like Boris Johnson, her former boss, did, and a couple of other MPs, triggering a by-election. She said she was stepping down with immediate effect, but it took her 2 months to do that. She has had a colorful career, to be fair, from her appearance in the I Am a Celebrity TV show, where she swallowed the anus of an ostrich, to her comments about the Muslim burqa, calling it a medieval piece of clothing, and call for a ban on the whole thing in the UK, and also retweeting right-wing tweets on her Twitter account in the past that were believed to have had Islamophobic agendas. And so she really has had a colorful career, Nadine Dorries, and a lot of people are saying that even as MP, since she said that she was resigning, she was an absentee MP. She wasn't around, didn't get the job done. But hence, again, came the announcement yesterday. And in that letter that you quoted a little bit of, I think it calls for some grim reading, if you will, as far as this government is concerned and the political civil war or infighting in the Conservative Party that has been going on or went into overdrive during the premiership of Boris Johnson and has been ongoing since. And just a quick excerpt from the letter to Downing Street, to Rishi Sunak. She goes as follows. Since you took office a year ago, the country is run by a zombie government, as you said earlier, where nothing meaningful has happened. What exactly has been done, or have you achieved? You hold the office of prime minister unelected without a single vote, not even from your own MPs. You have no mandate from the people, and the government is adrift. You have squandered the goodwill of the nation for what? And there is plenty more. She's right about all of that, the fact that Rishi Sunak was not elected by the general public in a general election. But then we have to again remember that this whole saga began under Boris Johnson, that she was a close ally to. I think they cannot move away from or move on from the fact that, you know, Rishi Sunak was the first to resign as Chancellor under Boris Johnson. And they're trying to inflict as much damage as they can on Rishi Sunak. With her official resignation today, there will be a by-election in Mid-Bedfordshire, where either the Labour Party, if any of the polls are anything to go by, either the Labour Party or Liberal Democrats are likely to win. And according to the latest polls, the Conservatives, this was conducted by Ipsos, the Conservatives are trailing Labour at 26% against Labour's 46%. The elections, of course, will be held next year. And if this is a sign of how things might transpire, then it looks like Labour might be on its way to probably a landslide victory, or a victory at least against the Conservatives after more than a decade of Conservative rule in the United Kingdom.
All right, before I let you go, what is the whole terminology of a zombie government? I mean, what is she saying? What is she trying to say there?
I think it's about those five promises or pledges that the Rishi Sunak government, the Rishi Sunak himself, made to the British public, or at least the people in the Conservative Party, or the Conservative electorate. For example, having inflation that, as we know, at some point reached 11% and has come down a bit, but it is far away from the under 2% that they have promised. Or sorting out the immigration problem and the plan that, you know, to curb the influx of what is referred to as irregular migrants in the UK, and the backlash we've seen against the government's performance as far as housing these immigrants. Remember the baby Stockholm barge that housed a number of immigrants, and the discovery of some kind of poison on the barge, and all the rest of it. I think what she's alluding to here is whether or not the Rishi Sunak government has achieved any of the promises it has made to the British public over the past year. And as I said, this again is a window into the political civil war in the Conservative Party, and it looks like it's going to go on for the next few months until the general election begins or is held, and in which the Conservative Party will probably experience a drubbing at the hands of Labour and the other political parties.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Saeed Pourhassan is there from London. And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on August 6, 2023, with a meeting with the commander's crew and families of the 86th flotilla of the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy. What I want to say is that the political value of your work was no less than its military value. The fact that you were able to carry out such a large task on the sea, that you demonstrated Iran possesses this amount of power, this number of young people, this scientific capability and this vast amount of skill, which allowed it to accomplish such a great task, brought about international status for the country. The next point is that there are several lessons to be learned from this seafaring. It had significant lessons. The first lesson is that it teaches us about God. The sea is one of the clear signs of God's experience. In the supplication of Joshan al-Kabir, it is written, O he who possesses wonders in the sea. The sea is the center of the wonders of creation. The majesty of the sea, the infiniteness of the oceans, the beauty of the various sights at sea, the fury of the sea in some places, the grace of the sea, and the amazing sea creatures are all divine signs. These are all signs of God. The sea is actually an exhibition of God's signs. So the first lesson of this seafaring is that it teaches us about God. A person's belief in God is strengthened. One sees the divine signs.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The second lesson is a lesson about the revolution. The seafaring shed light on the value and importance of Iran's Islamic revolution for us, for you, and for everyone who becomes aware of your story. Why? Because it was the revolution that gave us this knowledge, capability, and self-confidence. The revolution gave us the determination and courage to carry out such a great mission. There was not even a mention of these kinds of things before the revolution. During the period of Pahlavi and Qajar rule, we had no knowledge about the sea and its capacities, despite the country's vast coastal areas and maritime resources. The navy was preoccupied with other things. Fortunately, you didn't experience those days. There were some fair, honest people who told us what's going on in the navy back then. There were no signs of these kinds of achievements back then.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Iran has been invited to become a member of the BRICS group of emerging economies, whose leaders have attended a summit in Johannesburg, South Africa, to discuss the bloc's expansion. The South African President Cyril Ramaphosa announced on Thursday that the BRICS member states agreed to admit Iran to the bloc.
We have consensus on the first phase of this expansion process, and other phases will follow. We have decided to invite the Argentine Republic, the Arab Republic of Egypt, the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia, the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates to become full members of BRICS. The membership will take effect from the 1st of January 2024.
The five current member states have reached a consensus on the first phase of this expansion process. Reacting to the news, Mohammad Jamshidi, the Iranian president's deputy chief of staff for political affairs, said Iran's membership in BRICS is a historical development and a strategic success for the foreign policy of the Islamic Republic. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said Tehran seeks to promote cooperation with the member states of the BRICS group of emerging economies. He also noted that Iran, in its foreign policy, has put the promotion of relations with all independent countries in the world on its agenda.
And the benefits of Iran's membership to BRICS is going to make history and open a new chapter and a stronger step towards justice, fairness, ethics, and sustainable and lasting peace on the international stage.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping has said the expansion of BRICS will inject new impetus to the group's cooperation mechanism. This expansion has reflected BRICS' determination for unity and cooperation. He said this membership expansion is historic. The expansion is also a new starting point for BRICS cooperation. It will bring new vigor to the BRICS cooperation mechanism and further strengthen the force for world peace and development. Russia has also welcomed Iran's application and the group's expansion to include international powerhouses. Meanwhile, South Africa's foreign minister has said that leaders of the BRICS bloc have agreed on mechanisms for considering new members, giving dozens of interested nations a path into the organization. The inclusion of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Iran, and Egypt marks the first MENA representation in the group, and the inclusion of Argentina was championed by member Brazil. The expansion of the group is part of its plan to build dominance and to reshape global governance into a multipolar world order.
Excellencies, we are moving towards a multipolar world, and that is a positive thing. But multipolarity in itself is not enough to guarantee a peaceful or just global community. To be a factor of peace, equity, and justice in international relations, multipolarity must be supported by strong and effective multilateral institutions.
UAE President Mohammed bin Zayed said he appreciated the inclusion of his country as a new member of the important group. We respect the vision of BRICS leadership and appreciate the inclusion of the UAE as a member to this important group. We look forward to a continued commitment of cooperation for the prosperity, dignity, and benefit of all nations and people around the world. The bloc's expansion raises the question of potential de-dollarization, a process by which members would gradually switch to using currencies other than the U.S. dollar to conduct trade. The expansion also takes place at a time when some BRICS members, namely Russia and China, are locked into rising tensions with the West. Experts believe that choosing to include countries like Iran, have opted to choose a foreign policy independent of the West, could swing the group further toward becoming an anti-Western bloc. BRICS held its first summit in 2009 with four members and then added South Africa the following year. It launched its new development bank in 2015. More than 40 countries have expressed interest in joining BRICS, and 23 formally applied to join the club, which already represented a quarter of the global economy and 40% of the world's population.
Has reportedly begun unloading cargo from a seized tanker which is believed to have been transporting Iranian oil to Singapore. Suez Rajan, the oil tanker, has sat off the coast of Texas since May. Last week, a group of American lawmakers implored the Biden administration to end the impasse and offload the tanker. Ship tracking data analyzed by American news agency The Associated Press showed the oil tanker started ship-to-ship transfer of its cargo to another tanker, the MR Euphrates, some 70 kilometers southeast of Houston. The cargo aboard that vessel is estimated to be 800,000 barrels of oil, with an estimated value of $56 million. The spokesperson for the Iranian Foreign Ministry declined to confirm the report but warned the U.S. that his country won't remain silent on the violation of its rights. Nasser Kanani slammed the measures that involved attacking oil tankers carrying Iranian oil as a brazen example of piracy. He said the general principle is that the era of hit and run has been over. The spokesman emphasized that the Islamic Republic won't remain silent on any violation of the Iranian nation's rights, will show an appropriate reaction, and cut off the hands of violators. Already, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC, has warned that those involved in offloading the Suez Rajan's cargo should expect to be struck back. The IRGC's Navy commander, Rear Admiral Ali Reza Tangsiri, warned that Iran would hold any oil company seeking to unload its crude from the vessel responsible. He said Iran would also hold America responsible. Washington has claimed to have hijacked tankers carrying Iranian oil several times, arguing that the ships had been flouting U.S. sanctions. The U.S. usually auctions off Iran's stolen assets, claiming it would use the money to pay damages to alleged victims of the Islamic Republic's actions. Meanwhile, Washington plans to sell the confiscated Iranian oil and use the money for the victims and survivors of the 9/11 al-Qaeda attacks. Tehran accuses the U.S. of stealing its oil, saying the move is illegal. Iran has warned against the provocative buildup of American forces in the Persian Gulf, saying the move comes at a time when regional countries are improving their relations. Tehran says the security of the region, especially that of the Persian Gulf waterway, must be ensured within the region itself by the Persian Gulf states. In this regard, Iran, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman are to form a joint naval force under China's auspices towards enhancing maritime security in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz. The Strait of Hormuz is a key strategic strip of water between the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman, where near a third of the world's oil flows through. Back in July, the U.S. military announced it has deployed 3,000 sailors and marine forces to West Asia under the pretext of protecting ships and vessels crossing the main waterways in the region. A recently released footage from Iran showed an encounter on August 17th involving the USS Bataan and USS Thomas Hutner. The video footage released by the naval force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC, showed Iranian speedboats issuing warnings to a U.S. helicopter carrier in the Strait of Hormuz, forcing the warship to ground its choppers before they can enter Iran's territorial waters. The commander of the IRGC Navy, Rear Admiral Ali Reza Tangsiri, said his force's success in monitoring maritime movements in the Persian Gulf and their vigilance in the face of threats, particularly from the warships of extra-regional countries, proved that the Iranian forces would never allow enemies to undermine security in this strategic region. Iran has made it clear that it views U.S. military vessels lurking in the waters of the Persian Gulf as a threat to its national security and a source of tension and instability in the region. The Islamic Republic has repeatedly vowed to give a decisive response to any hostile move by Washington that would disrupt the security of the strategic waterway.
Nearly 1 month into a military coup in Niger, the situation remains tense there as the country grapples with political uncertainty. As part of efforts to reverse last month's coup, a delegation from West Africa's main regional bloc, ECOWAS, has met with junta leader General Abdourahamane Tiani in the capital, Niamey. The delegation led by Nigeria's former military leader, Abdoulsalami Abubakar, and accompanied by ECOWAS Commission President Omar Touré, has also met with Nigeria's ousted President Mohamed Bazoum. Although there has been no detail on the outcome of the talks, General Tiani said in a televised address that neither coup leaders nor the Nigerian people want war and remain open to dialogue.
In short, neither the military junta nor the people of Niger want war and remain open to dialogue. But let us be clear, if an aggression is launched against us, it will not be the easy ride that some people think it is. they will be up against 26 million Nigerians.
Tiani said the junta was pursuing its own agenda and would launch a national dialogue to consult on a transition back to democracy, which should last no longer than 3 years.
I am calling on all the living forces to engage in an inclusive national dialogue. The aim of the body dedicated to this dialogue is to consult all the components of the people of Niger on the best ways to lay the foundations of a new constitutional life on pillars deeply rooted in our traditional and republican values.
Tiani's comments and meeting of ECOWAS representatives with coup leaders and former President Bazoum come as the bloc on Friday doubled down its threat to use force as a last resort to restore democracy in Niger. It said an undisclosed D-Day had been agreed for possible military intervention there. This was enough reason for thousands of Nigerians to hit the streets of Niamey to throw their backing behind coup leaders. The developments in Niger come as coups are normally rejected by nature, no matter the time and place they take place. But the public support for the military junta does indeed convey a message. The disillusionment and dissatisfaction with the previous regime can be named as such. A desire for change and a belief that the military might bring stability or address grievances that have not been adequately addressed by the previous government is among reasons behind the public support for Niger junta leaders. But in the case of the West's stance toward Niger developments, what comes to the spotlight is Western countries' push for a military intervention in Niger to reverse the coup. Are they really seeking for the establishment of a civilian rule, or are there real concerns that the persistence of a military rule would not meet the demands of people across the West African nation? Western countries claim that they are involved in a fight against terrorists linked to Al-Qaeda and Daesh. But taking a glimpse at West's interests in Niger proves that seeking a civilian rule in Niger for the sake of its people would be so naive. In the case of France, Paris is seeking to maintain its grip on valuable uranium reserves in Niger. After all, the French government is entirely dependent on Niger, as some 25% of Niger's uranium production goes to France. Using that uranium to produce electricity, Paris has become a large exporter of power that goes to Germany and other European countries. This makes France huge profits, which make it hard for Paris to admit new political changes in Niger. In the case of the United States, Washington is seeing a growing tendency toward Russia among people in West African nations, including Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali. Maybe that's why, seeing its political interests in tatters, Washington is pushing for a military intervention in Niger to reinstate the pro-Western president. All what it is, the fact that Niger belongs to Nigerians and they're the ones who should decide their own fate is of very high significance. Given all the anti-West hatred among the people of Niger and other nations across the Sahel region, it seems that it is for the West to stop meddling in the affairs of those countries and let the people decide their own political future. The situation remains volatile around Taiwan as Chinese military has carried out joint exercises there. In a statement, the Chinese Defense Ministry said it carried out joint naval and air combat readiness patrols around the island. It said it was holding the exercises and training of naval and air forces, focusing on ship-aircraft coordination and seizing control to test the forces' actual combat capabilities. The Chinese military said the equipment deployed included destroyers, frigates and missile boats, as well as fighters, early warning and jamming aircraft that assembled in a predetermined area. Taiwan's defense ministry said it detected 42 Chinese aircraft and 8 ships involved in the drills around the island as of Saturday morning, and it had deployed ships and aircraft in response. The Chinese military said the maneuvers were a serious warning against Taiwan independent separatist forces colluding with external forces to provoke. Taiwan's government strongly condemned the drills. The Taiwanese Defense Ministry said it had the ability, determination, and confidence to ensure national security of Taiwan. The government's Mainland Affairs Council, which makes Taiwan's China policy, urged Beijing to stop what it called the intimidation and start talks, saying Taiwan's people were determined to defend themselves and would never succumb to threats of force. The council added Taiwan is a sovereign country and has a legitimate and legal rights to conduct normal diplomatic interactions with friendly countries. The drill comes against the backdrop of a visit by Taiwan's Vice President William Lai to the United States. Lai, who was a frontrunner to become Taiwan's president in elections in January, made a number of stopovers and gave speeches while on the visit. This stopover of Taiwan's vice president to the U.S. comes as previous instances of such diplomatic visits have been the source of tensions between Beijing and Taipei, and subsequently China and the United States. That includes a visit by former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi. Beijing launched joint military exercises around the island and suspended or canceled 8 official military dialogues and cooperation channels with the United States. In April this year, Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen met House Speaker Kevin McCarthy on a stopover in California. Beijing authorities blasted off some angry statements, imposed sanctions against a handful of individuals or entities involved in Tsai's trip, and sent warships and planes past Taiwan. Not to mention that several U.S. delegations, comprising of American lawmakers, have traveled to the self-ruled island and met with Taiwanese officials, drawing angry reactions from Beijing. China argues that any official exchanges with Taiwan will boost calls for independence in the self-ruled island. But apart from those diplomatic exchanges, tensions over Taiwan have been escalating ever since the United States enhanced its military buildup in the South China Sea in an effort to contain Beijing. After all, China has territorial claims over the self-ruled island and has warned against any move that jeopardizes its sovereignty and territorial integrity. But regardless of those warnings, Washington has continued with its collision course with Beijing over the issue of Taiwan. The sailing of U.S. vessels through the Taiwan Strait is just to name one. That raises the question that how would the United States react if Chinese destroyers sail through areas close to U.S. borders in the North Atlantic or the North Pacific Oceans, or anywhere near the Gulf of Mexico for that matter. Given all the tensions between Washington and Beijing, what seems to be further complicating the situation is numerous provocations on the part of the United States against China. From those diplomatic visits to sailing of warships to areas close to Taiwan, all seems to be preparing the ground for full-scale confrontation between the two countries.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord. His word Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, my dear sisters and brothers from all around the world. Welcome back to a new episode of
Youth Station.
This is Asma, it's your service. And there is Vita.
Vita here again. Our sweet home.
Yeah, of course. It's so, so happy and pleasurable to be here with you.
Exactly. And we are all honored to be here.
Same in here.
As, I don't know, everything. As our friends. You know, again here. is a blessing for me. Every week, every day.
Yeah. How are you doing?
Thank you.
I hope everything goes well for you and for all the audience out there. And I hope life is going so smooth. Life is a sugar-coated pill. Let's just call it that way. It's going to be more easier. Are you a kind of a person who talks about her sadnesses?
Not that much. I don't know whether this is a good thing or not, but I'm not that kind of person who can talk easily. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter about what. You know, it depends on the person I'm talking to. I have to put a lot of trust to somebody to start talking about my personal things, you know?
Yeah, I get that.
And generally speaking of these sort of things, there is this, you know, Freud's theory that you have to talk about your dark parts of your personality and you have to show them.
I'm not sure he said you have to say it to everyone.
No, he
meant
say it like
to
that.
Say it
yeah.
to a psychiatrist.
Yeah, to a therapist or, I don't know,
someone who's a specialist.
But even I don't believe in that.
Well, honestly speaking, I would have the same perspective, but then we have to add the very fact that sometimes these doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists, mentor, whoever you want to call it, they do the same thing. They would just work as a person who would just moderate or ease the pain that you have.
I know what you mean, but there is always this bug on my mind that, okay, I'm paying you money for just talking to me. What does that mean? I don't like it. Yeah. You know? They're like trading or something, and it's like I'm trading my feelings and emotions and my personal life to you.
Now, putting those people aside, well, if you do that to your friend, does that do you any good?
What do you mean?
I mean, if you talk about your sadnesses with your friends or with your family members, with your relatives, does that just look to be something beneficial?
You know, whenever I talk to my friends about my personal things and sadnesses and so on, after maybe 2 hours, I feel so regretful. You know, because of that, I'm trying to actually stop this habit of mine that I go to my friends and I talk about my difficulties. So instead, I replace my mother. You know, to talk to.
You're sure about her.
Exactly. I'm sure about her. You know, it's not like she's confidential or something because she's going to tell my father everything. But, you know, it's like I'm okay with that.
That's what mothers do.
Yeah, but, you know.
But again, this is actually their strategy to help their children. Because they think if they tell the fathers about the problems that their kids have, then together they're going to solve the problem easier.
You know, sometimes you don't really want your father to know about these kind of things. And
I get that.
Yeah. I tell her, okay, you shouldn't tell father about these. And the other day I see her, like, telling everything, with every details she wants to my father.
Now, the weirdest thing is that we would go for them again and again.
Yeah,
though we
exactly.
know they
you know, because
do that.
They are the safest persons.
Yeah, they are the safest person.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Oh, yes. Bita and I are in here, and this is Youth Station, IRIB English Radio. Well, we're talking about, is it good to tell our sadnesses to other people or the dark things that we have in a corner of our minds to every single person? I guess as human beings, we too can share some of the perspectives that the audience might have. Now, I just told you that I'm going to tell you about my experience with my friend. There was this colleague of ours at university, and then she was such a person whom just when she saw you at the very beginning, at the very start of the day, she started nagging.
Oh my gosh. I know these.
She started nagging and nagging and nagging. And you can't imagine. Her face to me was just a symbol of all the sad things that could ever happen in the world.
Yeah.
Sharing our sad stories with other people might be good. And at the very same time, it might give them some negative feelings.
Exactly. You know, I think sometimes you're telling other people your sad parts of the life, and after, I don't know, a long time, you're going to get used to that. You're going to get used to telling other people every little thing that annoys you, you know? Mm-hmm. And this is a problem, because sometimes you have to go through the difficulties and darkness of life alone. Yeah. And this loneliness sometimes is the remedy for real pain.
Actually, you're not alone, as in so alone.
Yeah, yeah.
Sheerly alone. No, it's not like that. I guess if you just confine to the one and only who's the mightiest of all, then you are not going to feel lonely. But then, Bita, there's another point.
Yeah.
You're my friend, and when I have a problem, I come to tell you. We're so close. So when I tell you about my sadnesses and my problems, I would feel like alleviated. I would feel like I'm lighter. There is no burden on my shoulder. But the problem starts when it becomes my habit.
Yeah.
When I come towards you for even the little problems that I have in my life, and I just try to make a big ado about them and then make them look like catastrophes.
No, it's kind of addiction, in my opinion. When
exactly.
You go to people and tell every little and tiny things that you feel annoyed by.
Yeah.
And there is this beautiful quote by Imam Ali, peace be upon him, I think. I'm not sure. He says, like, just don't tell everything to everyone. Maybe they're going to become your enemy one
exactly.
day.
Exactly. Okay? Even your friends, yeah.
Yeah.
Because there's
exactly
a big chance
friends.
For them to become your worst enemies.
Yeah, you're not sure about people and how they would behave towards your difficulties and so on. And you have to keep that in mind that they don't care that much. You know, they have their own problems.
Unfortunately,
even if they don't tell you, they have their own problems and difficulties facing in their lives. So you have to stop it.
Yeah.
And you have to find, you know, another way, like writing. Writing mm-hmm. is one of the best remedies for these
exactly.
actually disease to tell the people difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there are better things to be replaced.
Yeah, I do believe so. But we have to go for a break. Welcome back, guys. You're listening to Youth Station. Well, yes, writing also can do miracles.
Yeah.
I suppose it would work so good. It's even better than telling to other people, because whenever you feel regretful, you can just go to your diary notebook and then tear that paper apart.
Yeah, exactly.
Without worrying about the consequences.
I was telling you a but thing. Yeah. You know, there should be a
policy.
There
was a but before we go for a break.
Exactly.
And then now you have to fill that.
There should be a balance between these two. I mean, talking to other people and writing, going to nature or something like that. It shouldn't be like a kind of complex to you.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that you are sad about, everything that you are annoyed by. Sometimes people get used to not tell anyone anything. And this is a disaster itself.
Yeah, this would cause some sort of very severe disease.
Exactly. And I think the damages that it will cause is somehow more severe than the other part that you tell
other
people.
Yeah, I do believe so.
You know, when you tell the people difficulties and sadness, it feels like, you know, you make them sad too.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't tell them, this sadness will kind of get stuck in your heart. And
exactly.
Your heart is kind of filled with everything.
You know, there is someone in every one of our lives that we trust more than anybody else. So
exactly.
That someone is the person whom we would go to them and tell them everything. The fact that they're just looking you in the eye and then they're telling you that everything is going
to
be okay and you're going
to
pass this as well. So you feel like everything is over and you don't feel sad anymore.
Yeah.
So speaking to those people, I guess, does not have any problem. Except for in life, there's a fact we should just always think about it and take care of it. The fact that, as you just said it, sometimes in our lives we have to go through things by our own selves.
Yeah, I know.
And it does not mean that we're alone. No, there's always God and He's always there to help us. pull through. So it does not mean that we are that alone, but it depends on how you look at things.
And everybody has their journeys, you know, and life is your own journey. You cannot just put the responsibility of your life on other people, on other people's actually shoulders. So stop it.
And we also have it in our religion, you know, just as you said it. We have it that if you keep your sadnesses, even your happinesses for yourself, it's going to be better because there is always these kind of evil thought people who are looking around and they want to do you harm. I don't want to mean that, okay, life is filled with too much of misery around you. You shouldn't trust anyone. No, I just mean that sometimes we're not aware of everything.
Yeah, I get the point. And I think you mentioned something really beautiful. When you're filled with the love of Allah Almighty and the belief that everything that is happening in my life is like kind of an examination, you know, it's not going to be a big misery.
Yeah.
I mean, you can deal with it.
You know, I was just thinking about the poem by Edgar Allan Poe, who tells a beautiful poem about life. And then he says, life is, I'm just giving you the main idea now. I don't remember it just literally. A life is all dream within a dream.
Yeah.
So just if you think of life as dreams that come one after each other, then I think everything is going to get easier for you. There's an ending point to it.
You know, it's not like sitting somewhere and drinking your coffee and feel like, okay, it's not going to last forever, so I don't care. No, it's not like that.
No, of course not. We are breathing beings. We feel. We have emotions.
There is this key point that you have to keep the balance between everything, whether it is about telling other people your difficulties or not telling them or caring about things or not caring about things. There should be a balance here.
The thing is, when you look at things,
yeah,
specifically the problems and the sadnesses that you have from a larger scale, then you would understand that, okay, this thing, no matter how big it is, eventually it's going to end. And in the end, when it is over, when we are over it, then when we look back, we see that maybe it was a trivial thing and I shouldn't have put that much of thought on it.
And I think we forgot some really important thing to say here, which is praying, you know?
This,
talking to Allah Almighty. I mean, talking, literally talking.
Yeah, just looking as He's the one you're going to...
In front of you.
Yeah, share everything with.
You can share everything with Him, you know, without the fear of, I don't know, being...
Him turning against you, stabbing you from the back, or doing you any harm.
A strong source of love and beauty.
Exactly. So there are two perspectives. There are some people who do believe that we have to share everything with other people because we should not keep anything in our mind because then eventually they're going to turn into traumas. But there are some people who also believe that you don't have to share everything, literally everything, with everyone. And I guess life needs moderation and balance. So if you have that one person in your life that you can trust more than anyone else, then you are a lucky person. You can share your sadnesses with those people. But again, as my own perspective, I would say that it's not cool to share everything, all of your burdens, with other people, because sometimes you have to go through them all alone with your own God, and that's it. The only army you need at your back is God Himself. And I guess He suffices because He's enough.
He's enough for sure.
Yeah, you just have to work on your perspective and the way you look at things. And the concept of lonesome is something that is defined by yourself. Try to define it in a way that is the truest way, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is your story and nobody is going to write it for you.
Yeah.
You have to go through that. You have to go through all these difficulties, and these difficulties is special for you.
Yeah.
And this is specifically your life.
Yeah. Don't... These are specifically made for you.
Yeah, exactly. Don't make it public.
Yeah. Don't make it public because it's not going to do you any good, I suppose. Maybe at the very beginning, yes. But then in the end, maybe regret comes
in the middle.
So, yes, again, we're running out of time. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Until another session, I just bid you farewell from me and from Bita.
Yeah.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.